Facebook, Google, all of these companies are trying to figure out where are the rules and where are they going to draw the line.
There's clearly a demand for renters. They've got most of them full.
If you own a bond in your retirement portfolio, the price of that is going to go down.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
And welcome to Thursday afternoon, everyone. Steve Bertrand in the Allstate Skyline studio on this Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks very much for tuning in. So do you have a morning routine? Do you stick to it? Do you think you benefit from your morning routine? I'm a man of routines, unfortunately, and I don't know that they serve me very well. Later in the program, we're going to talk to Benjamin Spall, who's the author of a book called My Morning Routine. He talked to 300 business leaders about what they do every day to start their day. And actually, just reading what he wrote, I might make some changes myself, so I think there might be something there. We'll talk to Benjamin later in the program. Right now on a phone line, Ian Schur joins us. He's a senior editor at CNET.com. Ian, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm well. It sounds like you have a streetcar behind you or something. What's going on?
Yeah, I'm in downtown San Francisco. The traffic is so bad because of all the awful
fires.
Air that's coming in from the fires that I had to get off my bus and find myself a quiet space relatively to talk to you.
Well, thank
you. Before I even got into the office. It's terrible.
I appreciate that. But so the traffic is bad, but the air is worse?
Well, yes, I would say, I mean, the traffic is always bad, but it's particularly bad in the last couple of days because people aren't walking around, right? It's really like they keep telling us, don't really go outside, don't do anything strenuous. You know, it's really kind of a situation where, you know, it's causing a lot of people to be on in buses and on in cars a lot, which is tough. A lot of the schools have shut down too. My son's preschool is threatening to shut down, so it's a tough situation.
Well, I am grateful that not only that you're joining us, but that you made the effort to get off the bus for that. Thank you. I'll pay for the transfer. I will pay for the transfer. Hey, what's going on? You know, we talk too much about on this show, I think, maybe about Facebook, but it's got such a presence in our lives. And, you know, the whole Russia investigation has to do in part with Russian ads on Facebook. And now the New York Times is out with this story today that says Facebook, well, maybe they didn't know all along, but they certainly knew well before we went to the polling place in 2016 that the Russians were in on it.
Yeah, this is an incredibly unflattering story, particularly of Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg, the CEO and COO of Facebook. And particularly what they're talking about is that not only does it appear that there were a lot of red flags sent off early inside of Facebook before the election, but that it appears as though either Mark Zuckerberg or Sheryl Sandberg either were kept out of the loop, or when they found out, they deflected and tried to avoid it, and that they did not act responsibly is what the bottom line of the story is.
Okay, so let's start.
It's worth noting Facebook. Well, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, you tell me what you're going to say.
Yeah, so Facebook says that it's, you know, it's pushing back, right? They say that a lot of this stuff that's in this story, and it's a 5,000-word opus. It's really incredible amount of reporting by the New York Times. That, you know, Facebook says that a lot of inaccuracies are in there, including the idea that they knew about this stuff before the election. They also push back on the suggestions that Mark and Sheryl were not as involved as they should have been and a lot of stuff like that. But they don't offer concrete evidence that refutes what the Facebook says. And what the New York Times says. The New York Times spoke to 50 people for the story. So it's pretty damning.
So even in the days after the election, when this was coming out, Facebook said that they didn't know anything about it, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's the tough part, right, is that Mark Zuckerberg really painted himself into a corner by being so publicly against this whole idea in the first place. You know, it was very publicly reported that he had been very dismissive of the idea of election interference. And originally, one of the first quotes, if you Google it, Mark Zuckerberg crazy, you know, you see he said it, like, within the first week. So, and he said, you know, this is crazy, it's not real. And then, of course, it's become huge.
So is he reflecting that he was out of the loop and didn't know, or was he just lying directly to us?
You see, that is where the kind of trying to figure out where the truth lies is hard. You know, if you take what Facebook's statement and the New York Times story say together, there's still a possibility that either he didn't know or he's lying to us. And that's tough. And look, part of the problem here is that there's a trust gap. Right. Is after all the stuff that's happened in the last year, Facebook has a real trust problem with a lot of people. And that's not just me saying it. There are surveys coming out that show it. American trust in this company is falling like a stone. And there's a real question about what is going on here and whether or not we can trust these people that we've handed a lot of our personal information
to. We talked to someone from Adobe Analytics last week, and they talked about how there will be less holiday shopping through social network recommendations, just that people are going elsewhere now. Yeah?
It's possible. It's hard to tell. You know, look, there was definitely a talk for a while about how online shopping was going to start becoming a lot more social. And you saw people like Pinterest and Facebook and all these people, Twitter even, trying to push really hard. And they backed off of that. And I think part of that, you know, just from my own anecdotal watching the stuff, is that people seem to really rely on Google. And they seem to really rely on the retailers that they trust. So it's hard to kind of convince people to change by using Facebook or something like that. But I never bet fully on this stuff. You know, people's tastes change rapidly. And, you know, the retail industry is a great example of that. We were using apps for a long time and not buying from Target and Walmart and all
right,
that.
Right.
Now a lot of people have gone back to Target and Walmart. So it's really a lot of its influence.
The other thing I want to ask you about while I've got you today is this Tyler Barris case, the 25-year-old California guy who was sentenced for swatting, and his swatting from California resulted in the death of a guy in Wichita. Tell me about that.
Yeah, this is so sad. So first off, swatting is when it's something that exists primarily in online communities, and what you do is that you call the police and you tell them that there's a hostage situation or there's a bomb threat or whatever to get them to send the SWAT teams to someone's home, right? And it's a prank, but it has potentially dangerous and deadly consequences. So Barris, in this case, was actually asked by a person who had gotten into an online feud, so he wasn't even involved, gotten into an online feud during a video game to SWAT someone. And that the address that he was given was not the right address. So he calls the police, says that he had killed someone and was considering committing suicide and doused the home in gasoline. And what happened was they sent the SWAT teams, and this guy, who had nothing to do with any of this, suddenly hears all this commotion outside, opens his doors, puts his hands down, which the police think means he's going to do something, and they shoot and kill him.
Wow.
So now Barris has been sentenced. He's going to be put away for a very long time. The other two men are also going to be, they're in the process of going through their trials. But this is just the saddest thing. And the worst part is that there have been a lot of public education campaigns about how dangerous this practice is. We've all been talking about it. I've written stories myself about how dangerous swatting is and how dumb an idea it is. And now someone's died as a result of it.
And this guy's going away for 20 to 25 years. Ian Schur is a senior editor at CNET, and he jumped off the bus in San Francisco to join us today. I appreciate talking to you every week, and I certainly appreciate what you did today. So we'll talk again soon.
Absolutely. Take care.
Come on, Bill Geiger, I got to get it right. Bill Geiger's in the studio. Our conversations with Bill are sponsored by Geiger Wealth Management. Welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Good to be here, sir. Nice to see you again.
Okay, Christmas is coming, Thanksgiving next week. I'm not going to be here, so I don't know if you're going to come in next Thursday. But
No, next Tuesday.
Next Tuesday? Oh, is that right? Oh, you know more than me.
Yeah.
All right, so we're still in this very volatile time, right? I mean, do you see things settling down at all?
Steve, unfortunately, I believe it's going to get worse. We touched on this a little bit last week, and just before the show, too. Congress is, the House side of Congress is going to be in the Democrats' hands in January, and they have mentioned 87 investigations.
Wow.
That they're going to be doing at the administration.
That, let me tell you, will be counterproductive.
Plus impeachment proceedings.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if there's one thing that the market doesn't like, that's uncertainty. And that's going to be just a tremendous amount of uncertainty, and it's just going to ramp up from here, I'm afraid.
You think the volatility that we've seen in the past 5 weeks or so is just a precursor of what's to come?
I think it could be. You know, October was the most volatile month in 118 years in the market. And I think we're just kind of warming up for this. If you're in your late 50s or early 60s, which is our wheelhouse mm-hmm. where we help folks, this is kind of a spooky time, and I'll tell you, we're seeing a lot of people that when we analyze their portfolios, they have a lot more risk than what they're aware of.
Is this the time to give it a look to end of year? It seems to me like, you tell me, but December, there's not a lot of volume in December.
There's not.
Right.
And I think You know, we're still relatively close to the peak in the market. All these gains that we've made, you want to be careful not to give them back again. And I think it's an absolutely wonderful time between now and January when all the fireworks really start.
Right.
To get a second opinion on your portfolio and maybe dial the risk down a little bit.
You said earlier, and I kind of interrupted you, but that people don't really probably realize what position they're in, right? I mean, I've gone through that where you have a good sit down, you put yourself in the right spot, and then time passes, situations change, and all of a sudden you might not be where you should be.
It's been a long run, Steve. It's been 9 years since the bull market started, and you kind of get used to it. And you kind of feel like it's going to go on forever. You know, there's an old saying, an old guy in this business taught me, is that trees don't grow to the sky. At some point,
right.
It stops.
So is this the sort of thing, too, where, I mean, I would imagine it's like going to the doctor, a second opinion is not a bad idea.
No, it's not. And a second opinion gives you a chance to kind of reset a little bit. I mean, we are in the business of doing full-blown retirement plans for folks, and part of that is a risk assessment. Really know where you're at, because as you say, it kind of gets away from you.
Is that the sort of thing you can do with there must be online tools for risk assessment and all of that?
No, you know, if it was that easy, somebody.
Because, by the way, online, I'm retiring in 6 weeks. Just so you know.
Oh, God bless!
I found the right calculator.
Congratulations!
Right, it works for me.
So the knife fight in a dark alley for the next 2 years is not going to touch you.
I might be a little rosy in my assumptions, but hey, I said it. Well, actually, that's the point, isn't it? I'm going on those tools, setting my own assumptions.
Yeah,
I've got no business doing that.
And what's the typical? You get online, you say, well, I'm going to be conservative, 5% a year,
right?
And it goes forever. Well, if we lose 50%, it doesn't quite work like that. Steve, I think this is just kind of an opportune time to really get a second look at things. As a matter of fact, we're going to help that cause a little bit. The next five callers who call into the show on the number you're going to give them, we're going to sit down with them and do a complimentary, full-blown retirement plan. It's a $3,000 value. All they have to do is be one of the first five callers and have a portfolio of $500,000 or more.
Bill Geiger, we'll see you next week.
We'll be here.
Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. Steve Bertrand here in the Allstate Skyline Studio. Okay, how does your day start each day? Do you have a routine? You probably have a routine. I don't know if you said it or have done it intentionally, consciously, or subconsciously, but you probably do roughly the same thing just about every morning. Well, what if you set a goal or a standard that would improve your day by a new morning routine? Is that possible? We're going to ask. On the phone line now is Benjamin Spall, who is the author of My Morning Routine, How Successful People Start Their Day Inspired. I've stumbled over that, Benjamin, but I'm happy to talk to you. How are you?
I'm good, Steve. How are you?
I'm well. Okay, so I have to tell you, well, we'll get to my own personal thoughts on this in a minute or two. But first of all, you say that the choices we make at the beginning of our day can help set the tone for the rest of the day. Explain that for me.
Yeah, so basically the way that we start the day really spills into our afternoon and our evening. So we advocate, and we've had a website before we had the book, but we advocate in the book and on this recent article I wrote that it's really important to get the morning right and to do these little things that really create a better day in order to get the most out of your whole day.
And so you do believe then, so if you pause for meditation or reflection or to pre-wind a little bit at 6 a.m. or 7 a.m. or 8 a.m., that's going to have an impact at 6 p.m.?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely changes for different people. And as we note in the conclusion of our book, we say that, you know, you should experiment with things, but you shouldn't expect everything to work. You should expect yourself to enjoy certain things more than others. But meditation is a great example of something that really can, if you just sit down and have that moment to yourself, it really can bring that sense of calm onto the rest of your day.
Hi, Benjamin. So I'm reading I was on your website. I'm looking at some of the accounts. I'm reading some online as well. And I'm thinking, yeah, these guys, these women or these men that he talked to, they've got free time. They don't have to punch a clock at 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock. They've sort of lived by their own schedule. The more I looked at it, the more I think that might not be the case. But
Just answer that criticism to me, that these are people who have a little more freedom with their schedule to set their own schedule.
Yeah, that's definitely a criticism that we've heard before. And we actually made a point after hearing that the first time, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, we set up a full-time jobs category on our website. So every time we interview someone with a full-time job, we stick them in there just to make the point of, even though it may not be as easy if you have a full-time job, if you have kids, especially young kids, you can still do it. You can still like take 10, 15 minutes yourself in the morning to just allow that routine to take place.
So I'm reading the center, you know, I'm feeling sorry for myself. It's like, no, I've got to get up. I've got to shave, shower. I've got to get in the car, and I've got to drive for an hour to get to work. That's my morning routine, is sitting in a car for an hour to an hour and a half driving to work. And then I just started thinking about it. And, you know, Benjamin, until about a year ago, I would get up every morning at 4:15, 4:30 and go to my health club. And for reasons, you know, I would get, as it turns out, I'm going in the afternoon now because I get home and I've got blah, 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 who cares? But thinking about what you've got me thinking about, I realize now that getting up at that time in the morning wasn't just about getting the workout out of the way. It was a bit of a routine. It was a bit of personal time or time with my friends at the gym that sort of set the stage maybe for the day in a way that I hadn't considered.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And I definitely feel, and I've gone through the book and interviewing people, we found that people skew towards the routine, even if they feel they don't have one.
Mm-hmm.
And so often, especially when interviewing people, we'd say, you know, do you have a morning routine? Could you share it with us? And somebody would say, no, I don't have a routine. I just do these things every morning. And we're like, okay, well, that's relatively routine. So from kids to, you know, teenagers and adults, we all kind of move in that direction. So we make the point of the book, just, you know, make these things you want to do, not things that you've just kind of fallen into.
All right, listen, so I'll go to the health club tomorrow morning, but you might have to call me to give me encouragement at like 4:30 a.m. Will you do that for me?
Of course. Absolutely.
Okay, so let's talk about, you know, if you're in business or a creative, or if you're a mom or dad listening at home and you want to try to create a more positive routine, what have you learned by talking to these 300 business leaders? What are the commonalities there?
Yeah, so the most important thing we found is that it really helps if you keep your routine short and easy to accomplish, especially in the beginning, as this incredibly increases your chances of actually sticking to it. So a real quick example here, if you mentioned meditation earlier, if you decide one morning that you just want to meditate for half an hour every day that week, you're very quickly not going to stick to that if you haven't previously meditated, because that's a big commitment every single day.
Right.
So we suggest in the book, just do that for 5 minutes, or even just 2 minutes. Give yourself a couple minutes, sit down, meditate, and you'll soon find either you'll think this is a waste of time, or you'll think, I want to do this a little bit longer. So from there, the same applies for working out and doing other things. From there, you can increase the length of the things you really enjoy and kind of just drop the things that you feel like you're not getting anything from.
I mean, it could also mean just getting up 15 minutes early to have a quiet cup of coffee in the kitchen by yourself, right?
Exactly. We also, even though we do touch upon meditation as a practice, we do mention that there are meditative things you can do, such as just sitting with a cup of coffee, that don't really require you to change your day that dramatically, but it just can have a really powerful effect on the rest of your day.
Benjamin Spall is the author of the book, My Morning Routine, How Successful People Start Their Day Inspired. And I got to hand it to you. You got me thinking. I really do think maybe I'm cheating myself a little bit out of sleeping in that extra hour, that setting that routine might have benefited me in ways I didn't realize. So thanks for that, Benjamin.
Of course.
All right. Check out the book. Google them online. There's a lot to be there. Okay. Nice talking to you. I hope we can do it again.
Great. You have a good morning.
That is Benjamin Spall, author of My Morning Routine. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. Hey man, quick question. Do you like paying high gas bills? Because I love it. Okay, but seriously, here comes something that you should know. Naperville-based gas company Nicor is proposing a 9% increase in monthly gas bills for its customers starting next winter. Out of their clients, a monthly gas bill comes out to be around $60 per month, and this increase would tack on $5 a month. The company believes it's time for a bump in price, but this has been the biggest utility spike in a very long time. And you know what? Let's keep rolling while we're pinching pennies. Need to send a letter? Well, it's gonna cost you 5 cents more. Okay, fine, this one isn't that bad, but it's the 12th straight year that the U.S. Postal Service reported a financial loss because of all the health care and pension costs it's built up over the years. Things are likely to change, though, for the cornered part of the government, as Postmaster General and CEO Megan Brennan is hoping to work with Congress to relieve these financial obligations. But as we all know, working through the government can be a slow process, just like snail mail. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Thanks very much, Orion. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. On a phone line now is Tom Lochner, the executive director of the Wisconsin State Cranberry Growers Association. And Tom, well, let's just start by saying, help a farmer out, buy an extra bag of cranberries this year.
That sounds like a good plan. The old motto is buy two and freeze one.
So. You know, listen to me. I have a frozen bag in my freezer. I saw it a couple weeks ago from the holidays last year. So I did it. I just didn't use the one I froze.
Well, it's still good. You should be able to use it.
You know, it's kind of funny because that gets to where we are in a way, right? A lot of the 2017 cranberry crop is still in storage. It hadn't been sold from last year.
That relates to the nature of the crop. We generally only sell about 3 to 5% of the fruit as fresh fruit during the Thanksgiving and Christmas holiday season. And the rest of the crop is frozen and stored and then processed throughout the year. Couple of weeks as we look at the holiday season, we'll probably end up with about 20% of our sales, but we do encourage people to consume cranberries throughout the year, whether it's with juice or dried cranberries or other products.
I think you could make maybe an Easter bunny out of cranberries. There's nothing wrong with that, is there?
No, it works for me.
Tell me about, we've been talking a little bit this week about how Wisconsin is the leader when it comes to producing cranberries. And, you know, we've seen the Ocean Spray commercial with the two little guys standing in their hip waders and all of that. But it's worth repeating a little bit, right? Cranberries are grown in bogs in a way, but it's dry until it comes time for harvest, correct?
That's right. We flood the marshes for harvest, and then we flood them in the winter, actually, and cover the vines in a layer of ice to protect them from freezing. That sounds a little like a contradiction, we end up with an ice mulch. But during the growing season, it's a dry culture, and you can walk out into the beds, and the vines are a little trailing vine, similar to somewhat like a cranberry, only a little bit thicker and woodier, and they like a dry culture. They like moisture, but they don't like to be underwater.
So I guess I didn't realize that. It's not a crop that you plant every spring. It's a crop that it's like grapevines in a way.
Yeah, it's a perennial plant that we have plantings that are over 100 years old that are still producing a crop.
Oh, but wow.
Generally, the average planting in Wisconsin is about 20 years old.
And so was the flooding in the bog, is that natural? Did the early farmers find that happened naturally, or was that just a harvesting technique that was developed?
It was a harvesting technique that was developed. Cranberries, the original growers back in the early 1800s found wild stands of cranberries in the lowlands of central Wisconsin and began to cultivate and enhance them and try to protect from frost and insects. And they used water to do that by flooding to protect them from frost or protect them over their time. And then they discovered that them when they were wet. We were using hand rakes at the time, and they found that if the beds were flooded, that the rakes moved through the vines a lot easier. The water actually served as a lubricant, and then we evolved into the mechanical harvest that we have today.
Tom Lochner's on a phone line talking about Wisconsin cranberry growers. You were breaking up there a little bit, but I want to ask you, though, I made reference earlier to the crop and a lot being in storage, and you said, well, you know, that's the way it works a lot of times, but there is a bit of a glut, is there not? I mean, I read somewhere, I think it was in Journal Sentinel, that up to 25% of the crop this year is, I don't want to say going to go to waste, but it's going to go to uses other than the dinner table.
For years, we've been facing an oversupply challenge. What we've done as an industry is really approached from two different avenues. One is to manage supply, and the other is to increase demand. And obviously, our long-term efforts are to increase overall demand for cranberry products, both here and internationally. And we've seen a lot of success in the international markets to the point where we're exporting about 35 to 40% of our crop right now. And we see that there's a lot of potential for growth there. But in the short term, the USDA approved a 75% grower allotment on the 2018 crop. Now, that doesn't mean that 25% of Wisconsin's crop is going to be discarded. Because of the way the marketing order is written, and it's pretty complicated, but what it comes down to is there's a number of exemptions in there. So about 35% of the crop is going to be exempt from the regulation. And then when you take a look at where how they compute the sales history and the allotment, at the end of the day, we anticipate that only about 10% of this year's crop in Wisconsin will be diverted to alternative uses, and it will probably be put into things like animal feed, soil amendments, and other non-traditional uses.
Tom Lochner, Executive Director of the Wisconsin State Cranberry Growers Association. All right, Tom, look, thanks for joining us today. Buy two, eat one now, and freeze one for later. We've got it. We've got that done. I appreciate
That's
it.
Right.
Have a great Thanksgiving.
Thank you.